Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. New York State lawmakers approved a $254 billion state budget deal this week, more than a month after it was due. Echoing New York Governor Kathy Hochul, State Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins, the Yonkers Democrat, says the budget places an emphasis on affordability.
In this budget, New York has made a choice to stand with working people and to invest in people.
Senate Republican Leader Rob Ort sees things differently.
This budget doesn't address the main issue of affordability, even though it was the word on the tips of everybody's lip.
The spending plan includes $50 million to fund vouchers, and it'll send checks of up to $400 to millions of New Yorkers. Meanwhile, Governor Kathy Hochul and New York's legislative leaders are set to tap into the state's rainy day fund. WNYC's John Campbell with more.
The governor often touts her successful efforts to invest billions into the state's cash reserves. Now she's set to take $8 billion from the fund as part of the state budget deal. That money will be used to pay off a big unemployment insurance debt that has lingered since the pandemic, forcing businesses to pay higher taxes.
Call this my counter to the tariffs. I mean, it's not everything that's going to help, but it alleviates, you know, $300-$400 per employee.
The funding transfer is set to be in the final state budget. In Albany, I'm John Campbell for the New York Public News Network.
If President Donald Trump's budget is passed, New York could see hundreds of millions of dollars cut for major programs. His spending plan would slash funding for rural airports, heating assistance, healthcare programs, and more. The New York Public News Network's Emily Russell reports on the potential impacts to upstate New York.
Trump is calling it his skinny budget. That's because he wants to cut more than 20% of federal funding that's not related to defense spending. Democrats like Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer are sounding the alarm.
The budget either totally eliminates or cuts to the bone so many of the federal programs upstate New York families rely on most.
Schumer spoke Thursday at a press conference over Zoom.
It's an all-out assault on upstate New York families, a gut punch to our local governments, who lose billions in funding under this plan.
One program that would be eliminated under Trump's budget is the Northern Border Regional Commission. It's handed out nearly $50 million for about 80 projects around the North Country in recent years. Things like a new bridge in St. Lawrence County, a health clinic in Lewis County, and a food hub in Essex County. As Schumer said on Thursday, Trump's budget would also impact every airport in the North Country.
It would also cut 50% of federal essential air service. That would devastate North Country airports and hurt places or smaller airports. Watertown, Ogdensburg, Plattsburgh, Messina, Adirondack regional airports.
Those places have gotten millions of dollars in federal support. Ogdensburg and Messina's airports both recently got more than $2 million each for upgrades. Over the years, Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik has described the essential air service as critical. In a statement on Thursday, a spokesperson for Stefanik said what Schumer was doing was, quote, desperate fear-mongering, and added that Stefanik will, quote, continue to deliver EAS and Northern Border Regional Commission funding to NY21, unquote. Meanwhile, President Donald Trump's proposed budget would also eliminate funding for substance abuse programs, as well as for the low-income home energy assistance program. Last year alone, nearly 14,000 people in St. Lawrence County used that program to help pay their heating bills. With reporting help from Amy Feiereisel, I'm Emily Russell for the New York Public News Network.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week I sat down with Nick Rangel, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. We spoke about the Legal Aid Society's mission, which includes equity and inclusion, and how that mission conflicts with the Trump administration's order to remove diversity, equity, and inclusion throughout the country.
And I've spent countless hours reading and analyzing and researching the executive orders on this topic. There's a theme to the executive orders. There's the start, it kind of sets out an opinion or position, some concepts that the president holds near and dear, and then it gives directives to its cabinet to execute based on that lens, that new lens that's being applied to current and existing law. So as much as they are, you know, legal proclamations, they haven't changed the statutes that exist in federal law or in state law. And I think that's really an important foundation, that equal opportunity has not changed in statute. Anti-harassment and discrimination laws have not changed in statute. And the obligation on my organization and nonprofits under tax code have not changed in statute. And the regulations that govern the funding that we receive from the various governmental entities haven't changed their regulations. And so when I think about what kind of changes are mandated, are really truly required, I'm focusing more on what is our risk tolerance to having an investigation brought to that, you know, by a federal body into my tax compliance, not what is my legal obligation into DEI programming, right? Because the DEI programming, we have direct funding that requires certain types of DEI activities. DEI is not defined in law. It's an idea. And so what nonprofits are doing largely is making sure we're in compliance, making sure we're squeaky clean, making sure our audits are squeaky clean, making sure that our hiring practices don't inadvertently have any kind of language in the process or procedure that would lend somebody to think there's some kind of prioritization, which with us there's not, and with most organizations there is not. There's not really any such thing anymore as quota hiring. For example, it's like, you know, you don't see hiring preferences in any kind of documentation that says I need to hire this number of people with these identities or these protected classes. Like, that's not really, that's not happening anywhere. But what we are also doing is we're doing sort of audits of our online presence to try to reduce the vulnerability to us and to other organizations that we're partners with around what we are all calling kind of trigger words. And so there are conversations around having a lower profile online on our website, which is not where most people learn about the deep-rooted community relationships that we have anyway, but changing some of the language on our like external communications on websites, but then enhancing and amplifying our work on the ground, doing more community building and relationship building, doing more interviews like this to talk about how important we believe and feel that equity and access to justice is crucial to the justice system universally and to the provision of civil legal services. So that's where our conversations, you know, kind of intersect. Yes, we have to consider trigger words. No, we are not backing away from our commitment to access to justice and equity and inclusion as part of that formula.
So you have to be willing to move and shift with the political winds, but are you more vulnerable, or are you, do you feel safer because you're in a state like New York, a blue state, where you might get some extra funding as a result, or at least the climate where you can do your work?
So I think on the vulnerability is the external communications. There are Gen AI bots that can find those trigger words in an instant.
Give us a trigger word.
Race equity.
Yeah.
Right. So they find that trigger word in an instant, and then they can identify the, you know, the organization. They can find archived pages on that website. They can find edits to pages that were made through those tools. So you can't just take a page down or just edit a page. They know we had a page that said race equity at some point, right? What we can do is think more strategically, which we have been doing, and I would say should always have been doing, is think about DEI in a different way. I think about an equity budget internally, on how do I actually encourage more diverse employment. And I do that by providing mental health and health services for free through an enhanced EAP plan. I do it by having flexible work schedules and work from home technologies. I do it by enhancing training and professional development at all levels of staff, not just the attorneys or just the professional staff. So thinking about the how to achieve DEI just evolves and has evolved and should continue to evolve. So the words don't really matter. It's the actions in a nutshell, right? And we're talking about how do we make those actions more impactful and more meaningful. Externally, it does mean doing more outreach, more community engagement, working more closely with really vulnerable nonprofits and community-based organizations, those smaller organizations that are going to have less resilience or less ability to be resilient in the face of federal funding cuts and changes in state priorities, and try to find ways to support those organizations. So we're doing more Pride activities this year and sponsoring more Pride events this year than ever before, basically with that in mind. As far as budget vulnerability, I don't think there is any level of response to DEI changes that will save anybody's dollars. There is no universe where an organization can just say, we stopped doing DEI, and that is the thing that will save their money. And we can see that in the Trump budget, in the federal administration's budget proposal, that initial proposal effectively zeroes out the vast majority of discretionary funding for all of the programs that most people really don't think of as DEI programs, but are in fact DEI programs. It's veteran supports, it's senior nutrition, it's housing access.
What about legal aid services for the poor?
Legal aid services, victims, crime victims,
yes.
And domestic violence victims. Like, people don't really think about those as DEI programs, and yet those funds are just being zeroed out, you know, by this administration's priorities. Now, we do see that, you know, there's a long way to go before there's a federal budget. In his first administration, this was the budget we saw then too. He zeroed out everything that could be considered discretionary and then demanded dramatic cuts in even the non-discretionary funding, and then sent Congress out to go find those cuts. And so we have seen this playbook. I do think there are differences this time around compared to the first administration, that there is a stronger coalition that will demand a final budget that has deeper cuts than what Congress actually adopted in his first term. So as much as organizations have sort of budgeted or tried to play out some expectation of 20% cut to civil legal services, I think we'll see much deeper cuts in it, because they'll be deeper in all of the other departments. We have a low-income taxpayer program through the Treasury. It just helps low-income people handle their taxes. It is not a DEI program at all, but it will likely see some federal funding cuts. And so now we're thinking more broadly, where are we going to see those cuts, and how much of an impact will that have on us and on the state of New York?
That's Nick Rangel, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Five regional airports across New York's North Country are at risk of losing essential air service funding that subsidizes airlines serving rural airports. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley explains.
The federal government created the Essential Air Service to guarantee smaller commercial airports receive a, quote, minimum level of scheduled air service, unquote. The program currently provides more than $591 million to airports across the country and Puerto Rico. The Trump administration is proposing a reduction of $308 million. At Plattsburgh International Airport, Contour Airlines provides the Essential Air Service. Airport manager Chris Craig says the carrier receives a nearly $6.5 million annual subsidy over 3 years from the Essential Air Service.
It is our daily service. I mean, we do have Allegiant here, and that's more leisure-focused, but the Essential Air Service is, you know, for those folks that are, you know, our businesses, you know, people that are trying to connect to, you know, other locations, it provides that connectivity for our community, for businesses, and it's an important piece to the economic growth and the quality of life up here. And losing that would be certainly detrimental to our economic growth and quality of life.
Clinton County Legislature Chair Mark Henry, a Republican, says the EAS funding is crucial to maintain air service at Plattsburgh International.
They're talking about a 50 or 58% reduction, and if that is true, I don't know how those affected airlines, not just here but other places, would continue to service the area. The ability to have essential air service to an area has an economic impact. It helps with marketing. Now, it's early days, so I'd like to hedge my bet a little bit that there may be something that will be worked out, but it would certainly have a very powerful negative impact on the airline flying out of our airport.
North Country Chamber of Commerce President Gary Douglas notes that losing or cutting the Essential Air Service program would in turn undermine business activity across the region.
Certainly would be an economic loss beyond just the loss of passengers and activity at the airport, particularly in our situation with Contour now having a restored service to Dulles. A very important business connection, particularly for our international business community in the Plattsburgh region. There would be an underlying loss of economic vitality and competitiveness that goes with actually having a connection like that here in Plattsburgh. And by the way, it's only fair that the airports in areas like Plattsburgh and Watertown and Messina and et cetera get to have air connections also.
The Watertown, Ogdensburg, Messina, and Adirondack regional airports are also at risk of cuts to the Essential Air Service.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
A series of new and expanded dairy plants across upstate New York have farmers preparing for growth. WXXI's Brian Sharp reports there is optimism, but also unease.
On a dairy farm northeast of Leroy in Genesee County, Natasha Stein Sutherland is trying to steer dozens of cows to the milking parlor. Her family has been farming here for three generations.
There were three farms on this road growing up.
And now there's...
We're the last one that's dairy. There is a point where scale and efficiency truly do take over.
This is a mid-sized dairy farm with 1,800 cows. It had just 700 a decade ago.
So truly, I mean, we've been on an exponential growth plane ever since. We will be moving dirt this spring. We will be building a new milking parlor. The change in dairy in New York State is really rapidly happening in terms of everyone's scaling up.
Dairy is New York's largest agricultural sector, and New York is one of the top dairy-producing states in the nation. Business has been good, creating pressure and incentive for farmers to grow. While that has driven some to consolidate or shut down, others have sought to capitalize and expand, with still a lot more business coming.
The Fairlife Project, Great Lakes Cheese Project, there's a ice cream plant in Dunkirk, Blue Bunny, maybe?
That's John Muller, another dairy farmer.
So all this expansion created, obviously, a lot of optimism in an industry. And confidence going forward that there'll be milk markets.
The second-generation Muller family farm, Willowbend, is in Ontario County and is well-positioned for this moment. It's big, three farms in all with 6,000 cows, double the number it had a decade ago. They plan to put up another barn next year to bring in hundreds more.
Other dairies seem to be ramping up pretty dramatically. You see lots of dirt moved and barns being built, and cattle prices are quite high because there's quite a demand for cows to fill these barns.
These are multi-million dollar investments, but it's not just American companies and consumers driving the growth. It's also exports, and the big three markets are Mexico, Canada, and China. So for dairy farmers like Mueller and Stein Sutherland, the on-again, off-again tariff talk is a concern.
Tariffs hurt us horrifically during the first Trump administration.
Then, as now, it was a trade war with China. The Trump administration blamed China back then for unjustified retaliation and ended up paying billions of dollars to farmers to offset the damage. There is talk of doing that again as milk futures prices are falling. Christopher Wolf is a professor of agricultural economics at Cornell University, and he's been watching it all.
Our farmers are feeling this directly right now because every time he makes an announcement, the market goes in the other direction, right?
So yeah, that's the worry. If those markets dip, Mueller says, product backs up, prices drop.
Pile that on top of labor that we're worried about. This is anxious times, right?
The labor that they're worried about is immigrant workers, who represent roughly half the workforce. Many of those folks have been here for decades, but that doesn't mean their paperwork is in order. Stepped up immigration enforcement has spread rumor and fear. More uncertainty for an upstate dairy market poised for growth, but at the mercy of ever-changing directives from Washington.
I'm nervous about today. I'm nervous for our industry. I'm nervous for our country.
In Rochester, I'm Brian Sharp for the New York Public News Network.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gastina. New York State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli was in Kingston this week to tout the city's fiscal stability amid a number of recent investments. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King reports.
DiNapoli, a Democrat, presented the city's latest economic and fiscal profile to local leaders at the Heritage Area Visitors Center by the Kingston waterfront. From the Kingston Center at SUNY Ulster to flood mitigation projects, DiNapoli says the city has smartly planned investments to spur economic growth and address local issues.
The kinds of budget choices and debt choices that the city is making are all part of a very thoughtful plan to really build for the future. And to recognize that if very thoughtful plans, in fact, are going to become reality and going to be implemented, you do have to make the investment.
The state controller's office regularly compiles profiles of major cities across the state and grants fiscal stress scores to help municipalities track their financial health. DiNapoli says Kingston has never received a fiscal stress designation from the state since the program began in 2013. In his presentation, DiNapoli specifically celebrated the city's Weaving Waterfront project to redevelop the waterfront with walking and biking trails. The project won $22 million in federal funding in 2023. DiNapoli says Kingston's $10 million Downtown Revitalization Initiative grant has also gone far, contributing to the recently completed Dietz Stadium and a variety of projects in the Stockade District. That said, the city still faces its fair share of challenges, the biggest being the housing crisis. DiNapoli says median home prices in Kingston surged more than 63% from 2018 to 2023, nearly double the increase seen across the state during that period, to a median value of more than $277,000. Rent is also significantly higher since before the pandemic, with roughly 57% of Kingston renters spending more than 30% of their household income on housing. DiNapoli notes this issue isn't unique to Kingston. He praised the city's efforts to increase housing and address affordability, including the new zoning code it adopted in 2023 and its decision to opt into rent control.
The city was also one of the first municipalities outside of New York City to exempt from property taxes certain newly constructed or converted rental housing.
He warns the city should keep an eye on its budget and debt. In 2023, its general fund balance stood at $12.3 million, but the city dipped into that to the tune of roughly $4.8 million across 2024 and 2025. The Kingston Common Council had to vote to override the state property tax cap last year. DiNapoli attributes this to rising costs, including the city fire department's takeover of ambulance services last year. He says Kingston's debt has increased as well. It had nearly $69 million in outstanding debt at the end of 2023. But DiNapoli says much of it is tied to necessary improvements at the wastewater treatment plant and the Cooper Lake Reservoir in Woodstock, where the city gets its drinking water. Ulster County Controller March Gallagher, a fellow Democrat, says Kingston's investments will pay it back in time.
We have to realize that that is going to attract investment in 20, 30 years, not just public investment like the DRI, but private investment like businesses coming to the county and philanthropic investment, which the city of Kingston has, you know, benefited from so much.
Democratic Mayor Steve Noble says he's proud of the overall report.
This type of work that the comptroller and his office has done really allows us to be able to have that 30,000-foot view of how Kingston's actually doing. One of the things that I see with these reports is it gives us an opportunity to use it for really good purposes, like going to find other grant funding, because you have helped us be able to tell the story about the status of Kingston, both our challenges, but also our successes.
DiNapoli stresses that the profile is a snapshot of Kingston in time, and things could change as the U.S. enters a period of economic uncertainty. He urges Kingston and municipalities across the state to keep an eye on rising costs and spend carefully when planning their budgets for next year.
The state budget's being finalized, so we'll see what the impact will be on state programs, on local finances. The real question mark, though, is the federal government. And to what extent will there be cutbacks? If there are cutbacks, how severe and what programs? Be a bit more conservative. This city depends significantly on sales tax revenue. What we've certainly seen is that while there's still growth in sales tax across the state, that growth is moderating somewhat.
Reporting from Kingston, I'm Jesse King.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2519. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.